This is the Angry GM, and it is a month, which means it is time for a mostly monthly live chat, unless it's one of those months where I don't do one, which clearly it isn't, because here I am and I'm doing it. So, happy May to everybody, and welcome to the May mostly monthly live chat. I do have an audience here in live chat headquarters, live Angry Games headquarters, live chat studio, audience studio. Holy cow, I can't talk tonight. And although Nitsua does not appear to be present, frenemy of the channel, Nitsua, has nonetheless reopened the Angry Bingo thing. So I reposted it in the live chat text channel, and you should see it on your screen right now. So if you are present and listening live, you can click on the link and download a bingo card, and then as the things on the bingo card happen, you can check them off or X them off or whatever. And the first person to get bingo should type bingo into the chat and then contact Nitsua, and Nitsua will send you a book. This has nothing to do with me. This is entirely Nitsua's doing. So read the instructions and do whatever. This is not associated with Angry Games at all, but I call it out nonetheless. So, anyway, here we are. It is May. It is time for the live chat, and I have absolutely no idea what to talk about. And as I did earlier on the, or as I pointed out earlier on the live proofread aloud that I did this afternoon, I'm also having one of those days where my extemporaneous speaking skills are somewhat diminished, which you could tell because I couldn't figure out how to finish that sentence. But I have good days and bad days for extemporaneous speaking, and this is not one of the good ones, so you are in for a babbling, stammering, stuttering treat tonight. And also, I had no topics on the docket until I was remembered that I promised a couple of things last month that I would address. But before I jump into that, and then, of course, I will take questions and comments. So if a question or a topic occurs to you whilst I am talking, then feel free to put it in the mostly monthly live chat Q&A thread, and I will respond to it when I get around to the Q&A portion, which, depending on how long I yammer for, will be anywhere from 30 minutes to 59 minutes from now. So anyway, so I'm going to start with the news. And the news is that I have actually managed to get myself back on a regular content release schedule somewhat successfully for the month of May, in that in the last 3 weeks, I have put out 3 articles, and I don't mean 3 articles just this week. I mean, I have actually put out an article each week for the last 3. I have even managed to put out the live chat recordings simultaneous with the articles, because I've been finishing the articles a couple of days early, well, a day early from when they need to be published, which is apparently all it takes to get the live chat done. So, yeah, there's that success, and I have one more article coming next month. As I mentioned in the update this week, though, the May monthly update, the much belated monthly update, the first of the Angry Hacks tension dice will not hit this month. I am on schedule. I am doing well on that front. So it's, you know, I should have no problem hitting it next month, but it's just not going to happen this month. But you know what? We're going to take this as the victory it is. I'm not going to beat myself up, and hopefully no one else is going to beat me up for it. And you know, you'll have the first of the Angry Hacks next month. I've actually been looking into layout design and possibly even paying someone to do the layout, doing initial layout design for it, so that I don't have to do it, just to take that step off. Because what I'm envisioning for the, a couple of years ago, I started doing this thing called theme packs, where it was, you know, little chunks of mechanics. It was about 10 pages. It had some monster stats. It had some rules. It had some different mechanics. And I really liked doing them, but there were some issues with them even, and then the OGL stuff happened, and I couldn't bring them back for fear of what Wizards was going to do. So that also led into the slapdash thing. So they kind of fell off. And then there was some, there's a bunch of stuff there, and I'm not going to rehash all of that. I talked about it. But I do really want the Angry Hacks to come out in that same format, where it's not just, it's not an article, and it's not me yammering on for 5,000 words about these rules you could use, but instead it's presented as a nice, you know, several page rules document in PDF format that you can download and print or, you know, use a tablet-y thing or however you consume this stuff. That actually is a nice product that's worth it. And that's really the holdup. It's not the design stuff. It's just, it's the quality control. I really want it to look good. I want it to be tightly edited. I don't want them to be long. I mean, any longer than you have to make rules, but I feel like one of the things in, especially modern D&D, is there's a lot of words in there and most of them aren't needed. Like, this whole presenting our rules in, like, walls of text, prosaic textbook format is a mistake that is making role-playing games tremendously unapproachable, and it makes adventure modules unrunnable. So if I'm going to actually publish, you know, rules content, I want it to be short, sweet, and to the point. It's just the rules. It's just here's how you do the thing. So that's what I'm aiming at. And, you know, eventually, if I can't hit that mark, then I'm just going to have to suck it up and put out what I've got, because I can't keep holding this stuff up forever. The other thing that's happening this month is something that not all of you have access to, but some of you do. So some of you have been following the development of the Slapdash Fantasy Adventure role-playing game engine. And this is not a Slap Chat, so we will not be discussing Slap Chat or Slapdash, and I will not be taking any questions about it. But this Friday, we'll see the return of the weekly design blogs and previews at Club Slapdash. And if you are a member, you know what that means. And if you're not a member, you don't. But it does mean that you are still closer to having someday a Slapdash. And if you think you should be a member and somehow you have not been, send an email to patron.support@angry.games. And actually, that brings me to something else that I probably should address immediately. Because this gets confused a lot. And people have asked me, you know, how do we get in touch with you? Like, when should we, like, notify you or send you mentions or yada, 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 or whatever? Okay? And this is the thing. If there is something you need to get in touch with me because it has to do with rewards or patronage or it's any sort of, I'm trying to think, like any sort of, let's call it customer service thing, where it's like, even if you think there's a problem with an article or like you can't get access to something or whatever, if you have a customer service issue of any kind, email patron.support@angry.games. That is the way to get the quickest response from me. Okay. The second, and that goes, like, if I post an article and you think there's a problem with, now this is not for typos, by the way. If you notice a typo in an article, throw a comment on the article. That's the best, like, if you think the typo's important. I usually will make, when I see those comments come up on the articles, I will do one of two things. I will either decide that the typo is really not worth correcting because it doesn't obscure the meaning or anything. It's just a little typo. And then I will delete the comment, or I will fix the typo because I decided it's worth fixing and needs correcting. And then I will delete the comment. I don't let those typo comments stay. But they are the best way to flag something in an article as whatever. You know, that said, if there is something that you need, that you think needs my immediate attention, and I am currently active on Discord, like you see me chatting away, then, you know, then it's okay to, you know, send me a mention and say, hey, you just posted this and it's, you know, the time on the thing is wrong or whatever. Okay. That stuff is good reasons to send me notifications. The best way to get an immediate response is to send me a message via Discord. If it's something to do with an article or something that I just posted and just a general thing. If you have a specific customer service problem that needs to be addressed, patron.support@angry.games and give me 24 hours or on weekends, 48 hours to get back to you. Because on the weekends, I try not to be in the office too much. Okay, so that's just something that's come up a lot. And honestly, on that same vein, one thing that I really want to address in the very near future, but I don't know how near that near future is going to be, is I really want to clean up the Discord server, consolidate some channels, and, you know, just make it nice and then rewrite the like server rules and guidelines and channel list and all of that stuff. The server is a little bit too big for the level of activity that we have now. And there's just, which is number one. And number two, like all the rules and stuff are out of date. So that is something that I'm aware of. It's just a little bit lower on the priority scale than, say, getting content out. Okay. So the other news for those of you who did not listen to the live chat or the proofread aloud earlier today and who happen to be listening live now, because this information is going to become general knowledge tomorrow. But for those of you listening now who weren't listening earlier, today I announced the beginning of the True Scenario Designery course. That is, I have decided to start publishing True Scenario Design on my website. And today's, the article that is going live tomorrow morning, which is Thursday, May 23rd, is sort of a prelude. It's the philosophical thing. Right? It's like I started each of the true whatever-y whatever courses by discussing, okay, here's my philosophy, here's my approach, here's the way we're looking at the problem, here's what we're going to address. Okay? So this was my presenting the philosophy for true scenario design, which is something I called game design über alles. And for those of you who didn't get to listen yet to the proofread aloud, I will leave it so that you can listen to it tomorrow when it comes live or read the article when it comes live. I'm not going to rehash that whole thing. But just know that that is a thing. I have decided to push it forward. And the way I'm going to do it is for right now, every month is going to be two campaign management articles, one scenario design article, and one hack, or I will say hack, but it will be either be a hack or it'll be a piece of mechanical content. Okay. If I don't have a complete hack in the till for the month, it will still be something that is picking apart and building game mechanics so that we have some, you know, people management horseshit, and then we have some adventure building stuff, and then we have something that you can just use at your table somehow. Okay, so that we have that mix. And I may shift the priority and actually let true campaign managery end up being the once a month thing. But we'll see about that in the future. Okay, so that's that. That's the news for the month. And now, there were a couple of things that I had promised to discuss in the last live chat. I have forgotten. Jorkon just sent me a message earlier reminding me of them, and I couldn't remember them, and I still can't remember them. Even though I just read them like 15 minutes ago and then had to argue about Dr. Pepper being the worst soda, because it is.
Okay.
But yeah, so I did promise. Okay. So first of all, I was asked to give an update on Biscuit. Biscuit's fine. Biscuit's a cat. Okay. Her little life is... She sleeps 20 hours a day. She eats when I give her food. She plays with me, and she makes a nuisance of herself. I don't know what other news to share. There hasn't been anything particularly fun or exciting. Not since her birthday was last month when I got her the clacky ball, the clacky ball track that she could knock a little ball around in, which she really, really enjoyed for about 2 weeks and now has forgotten exists. And I got her grass planter, which, I've now replanted the damn thing 4 times in 6 weeks. Because she ruined it the first time, and because also I'm not great at remembering to like water it and trim it, and so basically I'm so bad at this that I can't even keep grass alive, which is literally the easiest plant. Like maybe if I got like kudzu or bamboo, maybe that's my level of expertise where I can keep a plant alive. So either way, between Biscuit and I, we are not taking good care of her little grass planter. So I just plant her new grass every week. And it's funny too, because I've been thinking, you know, man, I really need some houseplants. I'm going to get some green in here. I'll get a ficus tree. Or, you know what? I've always wanted to care for a bonsai tree. And it's like, oh, the grass is dead again. Huh. This is probably not the best idea to get a tiny tree that is notoriously the most difficult plant in the world to keep and care for, you know. But anyway, so yeah, that's Biscuit news. There's not much news. She's a cat. She's an adorable little pain in the ass. I can't remember where I heard a funny line recently. Like, yep, that's exactly it. Someone was saying, yeah, so the cat wrecked your living space? The cat's destroying everything? Well, no kidding. What do you expect? It's a cat. A cat is like a mean toddler armed with knives. And I'm like, yeah, that's it. Yeah. So anyway, so that's the Biscuit news. I also promised to talk about Demon Souls and Wilderness Travel, and it's funny that Arthur reposted that, and I think he reversed the order, because originally Jorkon had posted Wilderness Travel, Demon Souls, so I can always count on Arthur to be more interested in the Demon Souls take. Because I've done now... Is it four? No, it was three. I did 3 complete playthroughs of Demon Souls, which... Yeah. So back in November, after I managed to iron out some of the financial disaster that had befallen me following the apocalypse that was last year, I ended up with just enough money left over to treat myself to something nice, and decided to buy a PlayStation 4. And it was PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, PlayStation 5. Holy shit, we're on 5. Okay, PS5. Right. Especially because I had gotten notification that there was a Black Friday sale. It's like, oh, yeah, you know what? I'll do it. I'll finally buy it, because I've been meaning to play Demon's Souls. And I bought it for actually 2 games. I bought it for the Demon's Souls remake. And I also bought it for, and I'm actually embarrassed to admit this, because the game turned out to pass so insubstantially. It was like a fart in the wind. It was here and then it was gone. But... I can't even remember what the actual correct name of the game is. It's like Return to Moria or Expedition to Moria or whatever. And you are it's one of those like survival Minecraft-y type games, but single player. And basically you are a dwarf in Gimli's expedition to reclaim Moria at the start of the Fourth Age. You know, after the events of The Lord of the Rings, Gimli went back to reclaim Moria. And so you go down there and, you know, it's your standard survival crap game where you, you mine ore and, you know, break trees with your bare hands, and then you use it to build furnaces, and then you use the furnaces to make pickaxes, and then you use the pickaxes to mine more ore so that you can make a super furnace. You know the shit I'm talking about here. I'm like, that seems really neat. I want that. Even though I have never in my life managed to stick out any survival game of that type for more than a few hours. I'm like, no, this is the one where I'm going to actually do it. I'll stick with it. And I'll do the tech tree and I'll know which things lead to which things and it'll be all efficient. And yeah, no, I don't think I've actually booted it up since I bought it. I tried it once for like 10 minutes and then goblins raided my little encampment in the underground, which is just me. And then I got killed and I'm like, I'll come back to this another time. And I sort of did the same thing with Demon's Souls. I'm like, oh man, this is Demon's. I'm so excited. I'm finally going to play Demon's Souls because I never played the original Demon's Souls back in the day. But I, you know, like everyone, I jumped on the Souls train with Dark Souls 1. So, you know, I had never done Demon's Souls and I had heard nothing but good things about the remake and it was absolutely gorgeous. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I started it and I enjoyed it for like one or two levels. And then I'm like, I'll come back to this another time. And then completely forgot about it. And then I got obsessed with the Link to the Past randomizer for a couple of months. We all remember that. And then I just started playing random old... Oh, so the Super Mario RPG remake came out. So I had to, you know, replay Super Mario RPG. But I only got like 3/4 of the way through that before I'm like, oh yeah, you know what? This is a turn-based RPG. That's right. I don't like those much anymore. They're kind of boring. I mean, Super Mario, if you like that shit, Super Mario RPG is a good one. And by the way, now I'm thinking, oh, Paper Mario Thousand Year Door remake comes out in 2 days. I absolutely love that game. I can't wait to buy the remake and play 2/3 of the way through it and then get bored. So anyway, but I did finally go back to Demon's Souls. And I completed it, and then I completed it a second time immediately after, and then I completed it a third different time immediately after that. So in the span of, what was it, like 3 weeks, two and a half to 3 weeks, I completely played through Demon's Souls 3 times. Because I wasn't done with it, honestly. I enjoyed it enough that I wanted to keep playing it, and also I wanted to figure it out. And the Souls games in me, I like, there's certain, like, I have rules, okay? And it's the same rules I follow for all video games, but the Souls series tests it more than any other. Because, like, I will not look anything up or consult strategy guides or FAQs or seek any help for a game before I have played through it completely once. Okay? So I have to beat the game by myself. I will not, in the Demon's Souls or in the Souls games, I also will not use summons or I will not summon help from other players. I don't do the multiplayer thing. And I generally try not to summon helper NPCs, which is a mechanic in many Souls games where, you know, you can ask an NPC to come join you for a boss fight and help you. And often in the Souls games, the NPCs actually kind of trivialize many of the boss fights. So, you know, it's kind of a point of pride that I can say, you know what? No, I beat Ornstein and Smough by myself. It took me 7 days of throwing myself at them hour upon hour, but I did beat them myself eventually. You know, and anything I know or figure out in the first playthrough is what I have managed to figure out, though I will read messages that have been left around the world. Because in case you don't know, another Souls mechanic is that players can leave graffiti in the world, which will be things like look out, you know, ambush left, or, you know, valuable treasure ahead, or turn around, secret passage behind you, or more often, if you jump off this cliff, there is treasure, and then there will be a message next to it saying, don't believe the liar, and then there will be another message next to it saying, no, there really, really is treasure, and then you will jump off the cliff and die. But, you know, that's all part of the soul's experiences. That said, I won't play offline, because I just noticed Prismatica says plays offline. And I will allow the invasions, but, you know, they're not my favorite part of the game. But I do like the messages. So Demon Souls is an interesting entry in the franchise, because it manages to be particularly obtuse in a way that I can only classify as really bad game design. Which is funny, because I thoroughly enjoyed the game, and obviously many, many people have enjoyed Demon's Souls. Like, at the time it was released, it kind of got a mixed, like, it had a very mixed reception. But the people who loved it, loved it. It garnered a cult following. And this time around, with the remake, it has been hugely successful, which suggests that the time wasn't right. They needed some time to kind of iron things out. And it was Dark Souls 1 that sort of drew people in. Like, it was Dark Souls 1 hit at the right time. And even then, Dark Souls 1 wasn't super successful right from the get-go. Dark Souls 1 actually was a bit of a slow burn of popularity. But it then sort of opened the floodgate so that now Demon Souls can succeed. Because Demon Souls is not as approachable as Dark Souls, which is really funny. And so, essentially, it is, of course, a fantasy action RPG, which has excellent melee combat based on stamina management, you know, based on stamina management and blocking and dodging. So it's a mix of offense and defense and stamina management. You have to watch the enemies, get used to their move sets, know when to block, know when to dodge, know when your openings are, take advantage of the attacks you can, and then, you know, avoid the damage yourself, because any random mook is powerful enough to kill you at pretty much any level. Like, you can eventually get to a level where you're sort of not at risk by most foes, but even then, you can still get overwhelmed by foes in the first area and get cut apart very quickly. So, you know, it's very skill-based. Like, the stats help, and without leveling your character up a bit and without upgrading your weapon, if you're a normal human being who doesn't, you know, beat Demon Souls using only a Guitar Hero controller played with his feet, if you're just a normal gaming person, you can never quite get complacent with it. It always demands a little bit of skill from you, which is what I like about it. But all of the Dark Souls games, and Demon Souls is no exception, are typified by being somewhat obtuse. And there's always these hidden game mechanics that you really don't understand immediately. And so in Demon Souls, there is a thing called world tendency. And this is why I ultimately had to play the game 3 times to consider myself done. Okay. So the game is divided into 5 worlds, and each world is divided into 3 stages, sort of like Super Mario Brothers. I know some people are saying, you know, the first world has 4 stages. It's like, I'm just doing the basic rundown for people who don't know the game here. So game is divided into 5 worlds. Each world has 3 stages, and it's kind of like Mario. You know, it's 1-1, 1-2, 1-3. So the first thing the game doesn't tell you is that the difficulties are such that generally all the X-1s are of the same difficulty, and all the X-2s are of the same difficulty, and all the X-3s are the same difficulty. So if you try to play it as, I'm going to do all of World 1, then all of World 2, then all of World 3, it doesn't work. You're actually expected to kind of cycle around between the worlds, and more than that, you're also expected to eventually figure out what sort of play style you're doing and whether you're focusing on a strength build or magic or whatever, and recognize, oh, I should focus more on doing World 4 first so that I can upgrade my strength weapon with blade stone shards to make it more powerful, or, oh no, I want to do magic, I have to go into the Tower of Latinum and get all the magic upgrade. You know, you like, the game expects you to recognize that, which the game obviously has very high expectations that, you know, no one lives up to on a first playthrough unless they're playing with the wiki, which is 90% of people except me, because I refuse to do that because stupid pride. But there is this thing called world tendency, and the game has a menu for it, and on the menu it displays the icons for the different worlds, and then there's a little colored bubble. And throughout the game, you find references to it on messages that players have left behind, saying, like, at a locked gate, you'll see a message that says, if white world tendency, you can proceed, or must have black world tendency. So there's people putting these messages around saying that if your world is white or black, secrets be here. And then you just have this menu that shows each of the worlds represented by an icon and a colored bubble, which is gray. Okay. Now, the other mechanic to note is that when you spawn into the world, you are alive, which is normal. Most video games start you off alive. And then when you die, which you do, you are now dead. You're a ghost. And what the game does is it takes half your hit points at that point. It says you can have the rest of your hit point back, the rest of the hit point backs, when you have proven you know how to take care of them, young man. So if you break your character, it takes it away until you get it back. So you basically, as a ghost, you only have half the normal amount of hit points, and you become human again by killing a boss monster, getting through an entire stage and killing a boss monster, and then you can be human again. And then you go into the next stage, immediately get killed, and you become a ghost again. If you are like me and a sexy gaming genius, you will immediately recognize that nobody, especially not their first time playing, actually manages to get through the game unharmed and undeaded. So, obviously, the game sort of expects most people are playing with half their hit point bar. So, I'm just going to accept it and be dead. You know, I'm just going to play the whole game as a ghost. When I come back to life, fine, but I'm going to die and then be a ghost again. Okay. I didn't realize that I was avoiding, by doing this, some of the worst screw jobs in the game's really piss poor design. Because that, by the way, that's the first example of bad design, is that if you die, you have less hit points. And until you can beat some bosses and prove that you can play the game without all the hit points, you don't get to have all the hit points. Okay? So right there, that is normally the opposite of what would be called good game design. Okay, but now here's the clinch. I now play through the whole game, and there's all these cryptic messages. Like, there's a dude who says, you know, he asks me to rescue someone in one of the worlds, and I do, and I go back to him, and he's like, see how important selfless acts are? And now me, I'm thinking about this world tendency thing, and I'm like, oh, okay, let's be... okay, so this is how I, like, world tendency is like goodness and badness. And if I do good things in the world and complete NPC quests and stuff, I will make the world white. And if I do bad things, I will make the world black. Okay, I'm on board with this. Every time I have an opportunity to rescue an NPC or help someone out or do a quest or deliver an item to someone, I'ma take it. Now, number one, there aren't that many opportunities to do that. Number two, I complete the entire game doing everything I absolutely can. I scoured every level completely because I have to find every hidden item. And one of my little, like part of my ritual is after I beat a game like this, I will open up the maps on the wiki and I will look at all the items that, yep, found that, found that, found that, found that, found that. Oh, missed that. How did I not even know there was a path there? And like, if I have anything less than 95% of the items, I have failed and I commit Sudoku, which is, I do some Sudoku puzzles, which is traditionally how you cleanse yourself of dishonor. So anyway, so I have scoured this game and I have done everything I can. And I have after every boss, I go back and I talk to every NPC and I do absolutely everything. And the bubbles that indicate the colors of the world have changed not one bit. They might have changed. I did later find out that even when they change, they don't change. Like, it's very hard to tell when the world is shit. Like, you can tell when it's white and you can tell when it's black, but there's about seven shades of gray in between them and you can't tell the difference between them. So, okay. But also, by accepting the fact that the game was just going to keep pounding me down and taking my maximum hit point bar anyway, I completely prevented myself from understanding the world tendency mechanic. Because here's the thing. Throughout the game, you find these little items scattered around, these little pills, and if you take the pill, it gives you your body back, and then you get your whole hit point bar. And there's about 20 or 30 of them scattered throughout the game. So basically, there's 20 or 30 extra lives you can scarf down, okay? Naturally, most people will eat these things to keep themselves at maximum hit points and not survive. Like, even then, you're going to die a lot until they sort of run out of these, and then they just have to take the world at, you know, as a ghost and then wait until they find more for the next world. And as they do that, what they discover is that the world gets blacker and blacker and blacker. And then the enemy stats start to increase. Suddenly everything is more difficult. And then suddenly evil red phantom extra enemies start spawning into the game in places where there weren't enemies before. Okay? Because if you die when you are alive, instead of when you're a ghost, the world slides toward blackness. And the blacker the world, the more difficult the game. So if you foolishly restore your humanity by eating an extra life so that you're equal to the threats you're facing, and then don't immediately win after that, you are rendering the game more and more difficult. The more you die and the more resources you consume on your way to death, the harder the game becomes. So I avoided that. I did not discover that, but I did later find out that this was a major sticking point for a lot of people who played it, that for reasons they did not even understand, they kept dying and they kept eating more and more humanity pills. The game just got more and more punishing. Like, it became more brutal the harder the game was. Okay? So, meanwhile, here's the other thing now. If you accept the game at its premise and just be like, yeah, I'm just a ghost. I'm not even going to eat these pills because I'm just going to die again. I'm just going to stay a ghost for the whole game because screw this. You know, there's no reason to waste them. I'm not going to survive this run either. You know, like, eventually I'm going to succeed at a run at this world, but I've already failed 7 times. Probability isn't high that this is going to be the one. I'm not even going to bother with the pill. I'm just going to get really good at playing the game with half my hit points. Okay, if you do that, the game gets easier and easier, and the world becomes white. And if you play it the way I played it, the game stays perfectly balanced neutral. Because, oh, wait. Yeah, oh, what am I forgetting? Oh, right. This is the other thing. So killing bosses makes the world more white. Dying when you're alive makes the world more black. So the general way I ended up playing it was like this. I would go through, I would get killed. My world would shift slightly black. I would say, to hell with it. I'm not taking a humanity pill. I'm just going to play like this, get through, finally beat the boss. The world would shift back to white a little bit. And then I would balance it out. Then I would go into the next, then I beat the boss, I get my body back. I go into the next stage alive, get killed, the world shifts to black. Then I say, screw it, I'm just gonna play it as a ghost, get through the whole stage, kill the boss, get my body back, the world shifts toward white. Then get killed in the next stage, world shifts toward black. And I managed to keep my worlds totally neutral and never even notice there was a world tendency mechanic. But now, I finished the game, beat all the bosses, and did this whole thing. And I'm like, okay. So I obviously had, I have no idea what the world tendency thing is, but I at least beat the whole game, and I killed the boss, and, you know, I killed the final boss. Everything is fine. Okay. I'm not going to look anything up. I'm going to play this again. I'm going to figure this shit out. But I was going to allow myself to ask questions of two friends, that is Arthur and Knox, who played it and were waiting for me to play it so that we could talk about it. And I noticed something odd in the hub world, because there's a hub world from which you go into all the other worlds. When players playing the game who aren't you die, they sometimes leave a bloodstain in your world. So someone else playing the game somewhere, they get killed, the game spawns a bloodstain where they died in my world, and if I lick it, not literally, that's just me being funny, if you lick that bloodstain, a phantom of the player will appear and you will see how they died. And often, it is a useful way for you to discover things like ambushes and powerful monsters, because you see a whole bunch of bloodstains on the ground and you pop a few of them and they all go walking up to the next, you know, corner. Dump-y-dump, I'm walking up to the next corner. And then all of a sudden, wham, they get slammed against the left-hand wall, drop dead. You're like, okay, there's something waiting to the right over there. So it's kind of useful to actually pop these and see what they do. A lot of people died in the hub world. And they died in the hub world in a very specific way. They were all throwing themselves off a high cliff and falling to their death. Like, this is a very, very strange thing to do. Because as far as I know, there's like no hostility in the hub world. And there's not, and it's very odd. And I kept looking at all of them. And that's when my brain started running through, Why would people kill themselves in the hub world? And that's when I asked my buddies Arthur and Knox, all right, world tendency. Don't give me too many spoilers. Let's just do like yes or no 20 questions thing. I have questions. It has something to do with dying when you're alive, when you're human, right? They're like, yes. And I said, if you die when you're human, based on the lore of the world, does that feed the demons? Because when humans die, their souls are eaten by demons and it makes more demons. And like, yes. Like, so dying in human form makes the world blacker. Like, yes. Okay. So now I had everything I needed to know. The reason people are killing themselves in the hub world is because every time they come back to life for killing a boss, they don't want to die in one of the game's actual worlds because they will slide the world back to black. If you kill yourself in the hub world, you can then go back and play the stage, and then by beating the bosses and never dying when you're alive, you will push the worlds to white and be able to experience all of the hidden bonus content that comes with the world being white. On top of that, if you then eat all your humanity pills and kill yourself repeatedly in the worlds, you can then push them all the way black and be able to experience all of the bonus content that is hidden in the black worlds. And so I dedicated myself to doing precisely this. I was going to do another playthrough. I was going to do it exactly like that. I was going to experience everything that is in the white world and everything that is in the black world, all the bonus content, find all the items. I can say, honestly, I did it mostly myself with just some gentle questioning of my friends. And I was going to hear all the NPC dialogue. And I did it, and I discovered that basically in each world, if you shift them all to white and black, there is really no substantial hidden content whatsoever. There's like, in two of the worlds, there's one little side area you can get to where you can fight a dude, fight one extra dude. And in the rest of the worlds, there's one NPC that basically will ask you, go fetch this thing. And then if you give it to them, they give you one item. So and there's a place where I was envisioning the bonus content. Like there's a lava river with items floating in it at the bottom of one place. And I'm like, I bet if I turn the world white, the lava will cool and I can get those items. Nope. It's just one little extra NPC standing somewhere that says, hey, can you go into the boss room and get this sword for me and then bring it back and I'll give you 100 souls. And meanwhile, the way you're expected to get those items from the lava river is to run out to them, pick them up, and then burn to death. That's the plan. Okay? So, I mean, at least, because I equipped every piece of fire-resistant gear I could and got them, and it was still just, nope, screw you, just burn to death. So it was like, okay, 17 kamikaze runs just to pick up all these items in the lava. Totally not worth it. The game is the most frustrating pain-in-the-ass thing ever. And there's a whole other story, too, where the world started fighting me because I got the world to be white. And then there's one world where when the world's white, the guy says, hey, I need this item. And you go find the item and you bring it back to him. And he says, wow, this is a really nice sword. I bet it would kill you really good. And then he suddenly attacks me. And I'm like, okay, so I kill him in self-defense. And suddenly the world turns black. And shit, I didn't finish exploring it when it was white. I didn't know the guy was going to attack me. And I have now killed a human in this world. So apparently any human that dies, not just me. Great. So there were two different worlds that did that to me. And there was a day where I popped on Discord and I was talking to Knox and Arthur. And I'm like, there's not even a point in doing this. The game just keeps screwing me. Every time I think I have it figured out, it's like, well, no, because you did that. Now the world is black again. And then I went into a black world and there's like this big like pill bug monster that appeared. I'm like, awesome. A big pill bug monster that wasn't here before. Because, you know, eventually you have literally the position of every monster in the game memorized. I'm like, I'm going to kill it. I killed it. And the world's like, well, the world has turned white again because you killed the primordial demon. I'm like, what? But I wanted to explore it when it was black and okay, you know what? Screw this. That is why it took me 3 playthroughs to finish the game. As far as my review and opinion, because I realized that this has now gone on for some time. So as far as my actual review and opinion, it's a fun game. It's definitely worth playing, but you know, just look shit up or just don't care. Just like play it. You know, play it as a Souls game. If you like the Souls games, it's actually the easiest one. Okay, I'm going to say that. And the bosses are different. Like, it's much more focused on puzzle bosses, which I actually found kind of fun. Like, most of the bosses have some sort of trick to them or some sort of a way you have to... There are a couple of skill-based bosses too. But, you know, most of the bosses have some sort of trick or gimmick or thing you kind of have to figure out. And if you think through it, You know, like there's one boss, the Iron Giant, where if you hack his ankles, you can make him fall down. And if you make him fall down, you can stab him in the head, you know, stab him in the weak point for massive damage kind of a thing. And there's a dragon that is actually a stealth encounter where you have to sneak to these two ballistae that it has set up in its lair aimed directly at its chest for reasons. And then once both ballistae have shot it, then it is stunned because, you know, it's a dragon. And then you can stab it in the chin. Its weak point is its goatee. And if but what I'm saying is that, like, the boss fights are more interesting and engaging than just, here's another giant demon that just pounds you into, you know, into paste, and all you can do is beat it to death with 1,000 tiny butt stabs, you know. So I actually did find the boss fights really fun. They weren't quite what I wanted. The world design in a few of the worlds is really good, and a few of the levels are not. The levels are kind of hit and miss, but and I definitely prefer the more open world design of Dark Souls, and not Elden Ring open world. I mean sort of the interconnected, sprawling world that you get in Dark Souls and Bloodborne, instead of the world being divided up into stages like it is in Demon Souls. Though it does use shortcuts and loops and other game design tricks so that as you make progress in each stage, you can unlock shortcuts, you know, back to the starting point, so that if you die and start again, you can skip areas of the stage, which is a way that you sort of lock in and checkpoint your progress, but in an organic way. So I really loved it. It's a lot of fun. I loved it enough to play through it 3 times, but also my own drive to beat the game, like not just beat the game, not complete the game and beat the ball. I wanted to defeat the game. I wanted to conquer the game, and it fought me hard on that. And I feel like I did it. And I also don't feel like that victory was actually worth it. Okay. I should probably switch to taking questions from the chat at this point, considering I don't know how much time I have left, but it's not enough. So I don't want to skimp on the Q&A stuff. Yeah, see, did I really talk for, what was that? That was 30 minutes of my experience playing Demon's Souls. I am so sorry. You were fascinated. Well, thank you. The producer says he was fascinated, so that's good. It is an interesting one because I will, you know what, I'm going to have to add a half hour onto this so that I can do the Q&A stuff. And then if I have time after the Q&A, if no new questions pop up and I get through the Q&A quick, I will talk a little bit about the wilderness game mechanics. Okay, so we'll do that. But I do want to get the questions out of the way too. Okay, 30 minutes of the clock just for questions, and any extra time I have left, I will start talking about wilderness shit. Okay, but Ice Bear is talking, so now, see, people are now typing questions. So Ice Bear would rather hear about what I'm cooking lately than give me extra time to talk about wilderness travel mechanics, is what I'm hearing. Okay. So it is sort of an interesting thing, the whole Demon's Souls thing, because the game mechanics are basically exactly what you would expect them to. The more you struggle with the game, the harder the game becomes. The less you struggle with the game, the easier the game becomes. That is generally a bad practice. And at the time when it came out, it didn't work. Okay? And that's the important thing. The reason it works today, and it's actually a totally valid game design, is because once Dark Souls and the other Souls games sort of introduce this idea of the community figuring out the mechanics and you having to, you know, go on, like if there's something you don't understand, you go online and you look it up and you read about it and then you try to execute it on your own kind of a thing. Like now that that is part of the Souls genre, Demon Souls design works just fine. Okay, because it does, it has these obtuse mechanics that really do drive you to go to the community for answers. And not for nothing, that's even what I did. I did not actually go to the wikis and stuff until after my third playthrough, and I did not, you know, read any strategy guides online. But I was reading the messages very carefully in the game and using them to figure out what was, you know, what was going on in the game and using them to piece together and puzzle the mechanics. And then when I really needed help, I went to two friends who had done it already and I said, look, very gently now, help nudge me in the right direction given that I figured this, this, and this out. Okay, so even then, I was using the, I also used the community to figure out the very, very obtuse upgrade mechanics. So while I would say the mechanics failed at the time, now they are perfectly valid mechanics for the genre, given that Souls is basically a genre of its own. And now I will move on to the Q&As, the questions, and I will start with Naopi. Did Naopi add another A, or has there always been two A's and I never noticed? I don't know. Anyway, Naopi, how do you feel about starting the scenario design course right now? I honestly have very mixed feelings about it, but I think it is the right choice. It just has me nervous. You're not okay, Alyssa. I just can't actually excommunicate you until after because it requires me to actually move excommunication in the roles list above the color for the mods or else no one knows you were excommunicated. So I have to do special things to excommunicate mods, but you are not okay. I did notice. Okay. So I have very mixed feelings about it and the outline for the course is currently incomplete. But I still feel that it is the right choice for a number of reasons. First, I don't iron my socks. Holy shit. How many times do I have to say that you can be excommunicated? It's like every friggin' time. Yeah, I know it was to Alyssa, but it's not. It's always to me. The iron my socks thing is the iron socks thing is all about me. It's a dig at me. It always is. Okay. I feel it's the right decision for a number of reasons. The main reason being that true campaign managery is now eating up 50% of my content and it's barely gaming related. I think it's important. I think it's good content, but also it's not exactly fun to write and it's not really game mastering. Okay. So I need some other stuff going on there. True scenario designery is one of those things that people are very excited about and they want me to put out. And it's something that I can put out that no one else is doing that is much more game related. And so, because I am aware, and I hate to, I'm going to admit this, my community is shrinking. Okay. My community has plateaued. It is starting to shrink. I have to figure that out and I have to fix it. And one of the ways I have to fix it is by, you know, offering, like obviously it's, you know, putting out irregular releases and fixing my release schedule and putting out stuff people want, but also making sure that there's something there that gamers are looking for that they can't get anywhere else. And true game mastery did that. True game mastery was something that drew people to my site that they really enjoyed and talked about. So true campaign managery is not having the same impact. I want to get that out, but true scenario design is something I'm hoping will bring more eyeballs on the site. It's honestly a marketing decision. But it's also something that people are genuinely excited about. And following the discussion about how to, you know, structure your campaign and not put monsters in front of people, one of the big monsters in front of people they can't beat, one of the big responses that garnered in a variety of channels was, I can't wait for scenario design when you're teaching us how to do this. And I'm like, yeah, okay, so I can't really put it off. The other thing is recognizing that my own scenario design has really dropped off immensely. In my own personal games, I am not super proud of the content that I've been running. I know I am not living up to my usual potential, and I'm sad about that. And so in doing true scenario design and confronting how adventures need to be built properly, I'm hoping it will help me build better content as well. Okay. So that's why I think it's the best choice. Plus, then it leads to a good mix where, you know, part of the month I'm talking about, I think I already mentioned this, part of the month I'm talking about how to manage people and the non-gaming game mastering skills. Part of the month I'm telling people how to write adventures. And part of the month I'm giving people actual game mechanics they can play with. That is a good mix of different kinds of content that will help keep people engaged, whatever it is they're looking at. So, business decision. Plus, it's something I'm excited to write, but that's a stupid reason to do it. Jorkon the D9, how have your personal games been going? Any good stories you can share? Put a pin in that one and ask me next month, okay? And I'm not saying that because I'm particularly down on my games right now. It's just that I've been running them very inconsistently still, and I'm still trying to get them back onto regular schedules. And I really do want to have good stories to share. It's just not right now. Okay. Ice Bear, have you had the chance to play Manor Lords? If so, what did you think? I have. And next month, if anybody wants, I'll do a little review of Manor Lords, same way I did a little 47-minute review of Demon Souls, because I couldn't talk about it a little bit longer. I will say this, caveat, the game is in early access. I know it. Everyone knows it. It's in early access, and the game designer was very, very clear. The developer was clear about that. It's like, look, this is really early access. I've been working on this basically alone for most of the time, and only recently has a team joined it. I know people have high hopes and high expectations for the game. It's not there yet. It's early access, and it really, really is early access. So the game did not lie. It has been totally 100% honest. The developer has been honest. I do not feel misled at all. But after putting in, like, I don't know, 15, 20 hours on it, I also think that at the price point of $30, I think I paid $25 because the first 2 weeks it was on sale. But after the price point of $30 is too much for the content that's in there. It's just not deep. You know, you can play through it once or twice in 20 or 30 hours, and you've basically experienced everything the game has to offer at this point. If you want to, so what you're really doing if you buy it is you are supporting the future development, which I am not disparaging. I am certainly not one to throw stones at the crowdfunding model, but I personally was disappointed because I actually wanted a game that was a little further along and would engage me for a little bit longer. So it is perfectly fine for what it is, and it is doing some very interesting things as a medieval city builder with RTS elements, or if you prefer an RTS medieval fantasy game with city building elements, depending on how you like it. Its tech chain is very interesting. The way you do city layouts is very interesting. But, you know, If you want to support the development because you believe in where the project is going, pay the $30 for it. If you want a game, I wouldn't buy it yet. Okay, favorite and least favorite bosses out of the Souls games you've played. Wow. That is true. Well, first of all, none of them from Elden Ring, which I've been playing now, because I never played Elden Ring. I played Elden Ring a little skosh and then stopped. And now I've decided, well, you know, since I played Demon's Souls three times straight through in 2 weeks, now it's time to do Elden Ring. So, gosh, that is... Okay. Absolute, like, there's so many different criteria for answering this question. Okay. But what really always gets me in the Souls games are the early bosses. Okay. The boss that kind of brings you into the game. Okay. So for me, it's Father Gascoigne in Bloodborne or the Bell Gargoyles. Both of those are really well done fights. Neither one is actually the first boss fight in the game, but both of them hold that status of being the first real boss fight in the game. And both of them have a moment where the whole boss fight changes. So that just as you think, you know, you don't get to that point the first time. You know, so after a couple of tries, you get to the point where suddenly the boss fight enters phase two, and you're like, oh shit, there's a phase two. Oh shit, there's a phase two. It took me forever to master phase one. Okay. And it's a really good way of kind of introducing everything that the Soulsborne bosses are really about. But absolute top favorite boss for no reason in particular, other than it's the first one that pops into my head when someone says favorite boss, is the Gaping Dragon. I love the Gaping Dragon from Dark Souls 1. It's an awesome boss. The end. October Foundry, how are your workouts going? Inconsistently, but better this week than last week. And Ice Bear 50, cook anything good recently? I've also been very inconsistent on the cooking for myself front. Last night, I actually made some very tasty enchiladas. I make my own homemade enchilada sauce. It's not like super hard, but I like to make my own enchilada sauce. You know, you make your own filling and you do the whole thing right. It takes a little while, but it comes out really good. So I did that. And otherwise, I've just basically been cooking normal things for myself. So, but that's what stands out is over the weekend, I did make a sheet pan chicken breast. It's basically marinated in teriyaki. And then I made it with like peppers and onions and pineapple and cherry tomatoes. So it was like basically shish kebab or like Hawaiian chicken and veggies, but as a sheet pan dish, which made it super easy, but it came out really, really good. And I treated myself to a pina colada when I made that. Cook anything good. I did that. Nicholas, what do you enjoy about Paper Mario Thousand Year Door? Did you drop 3/4 of the way through? Like you said, you might on replay. Okay. I haven't replayed it yet because, it doesn't release until tomorrow or Friday. Or maybe it released today. I'm not up on the release date. So Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door was originally released in 1990-something or 2000-something for the GameCube. And I played it back then several times, actually. In fact, I still own my copy. And so I have played through it to completion several times. Okay, but I have been waiting eagerly for the remake. The remake releases tomorrow. And because it's a Nintendo release, I'm probably not going to buy it tomorrow because it's a full price release because Nintendo, okay. So I'm being told the original came out in 2004 and because it's a Nintendo release, it doesn't matter whether it's a remake or whatever, it's 60 friggin' bucks because that's how Nintendo does their pricing. It's all 60 bucks, never on discount. You pay full price for everything. So I probably will not pick it up tomorrow, but I will pick it up eventually. I will replay it, and then I will probably get 3/4 of the way through and then just lose interest. The thing about Paper Mario Thousand Year Door is it is a game I absolutely love. From a gameplay perspective, it does some really cool, good, fun things. It's probably the best example ever of how to do turn-based combat well. And I don't just mean because of action commands. Everybody goes, oh, yeah, because it had action commands. I'm like, no, it had so much more than action commands. But anyway, it does many things well that make the turn-based combat good. But also, the writing in it is fantastic. The actual dialogue, the character dialogue is all, like, it's spot on. It is funny. And I mean, this is back when Nintendo actually wrote funny stuff, or when it was a third party, they at least allowed the third parties to make fun of shit, especially of Nintendo, because it lampoons a lot of the Mario tropes, similar to what Super Mario RPG did, because Super Mario RPG was also very funny. Paper Mario, the first one, which came out on Nintendo 64, was okay. But Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door was really funny all the way through. It was very well written. But here's the thing with Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door. It has some problems that make it very hard to play. One of the biggest things is that it just does not respect a player's time. There is a tremendous amount of padding and backtracking through the whole game. And there are a few things where the game thinks it's being clever and wastes your time a little bit too long for when it's being clever. Okay. Many of the levels have a tremendous amount of back and forth backtracking in them. And nothing is done to make the backtracking particularly interesting or fun. And in fact, the absolute worst chapter, chapter 4 for Pigs the Bell Tolls, the backtracking is particularly atrocious because you have to run back and forth something like 6 times to complete the chapter between 2 different locations, the town and the creepy steeple. You run back and forth 6 different times or something like that. Every time you have to fight all of the enemies on the way because there are all these narrow passages and clutter in the terrain that makes it impossible for you to avoid the enemies. And the path does not change. It is the same, you know, it's the same thing over and over again. But nonetheless, it's just, it's awful. Then there is an entire chapter whose beginning is backtrack through the entire damn world 5 times to hunt down an NPC whose location keeps changing, only to discover that while you were doing it, the NPC has returned back to where he started, and the game makes a big joke about it. Like, it's like, haha, I was here all along, and all that time you just spent. And there are some fast travel warp pipes, but even them are just atrocious to get to. And the game does that way too much. There's also a side quest system where you have to go to like the job board, accept the quest, then you have to walk to the quest giver and talk to them so that they can tell you the quest. Then you have to go do the quest and then return to the quest giver and then return to the job board. It doesn't need to be this way. So it is a very, very hard game to replay because it just doesn't respect your time. Okay. Caladrev, what did you want to say about wilderness travel? Do I have time for this proselytes? I don't think. How much time do I have? Okay. Dusty is asking, how are you? I'm not skiving. I'm circling back. Okay. Questions are closed. No more questions from the peanut gallery. Dusty is asking how I am, which I really appreciate. I'm having a difficult time in my life. It is continuing to be difficult. I am healing and recovering extremely slowly, and I am going through a period of very difficult sadness right now. But I'm also catching up and doing the things I need to do, and it is a matter of time, and I have some wonderful friends who are supporting me, and in a lot of ways, I am extremely blessed. It's hard to focus on that right now, so I have to keep reminding myself of it. But hey, you know what? I'm recovering. And it's the best anyone could be doing in my situation. And on top of that, you know, there's a lot of people who have a lot of problems in the world, and mine are pretty small. I'm not in imminent danger. You know, nothing is collapsing or anything. It's just dealing with grief and anxiety right now, which is going to take time. Okay. Classical rulebook Angrican is asking whether or not I can share my my enchilada sauce recipe. And actually, I can't even claim credit for it because it's not my... I think I've made some minor changes to it, but the basic recipe works. So I'm just going to link the basic recipe here. It is on a site called Happily Unprocessed, and it is literally called Simply the Best Red Enchilada Sauce Ever. And it comes out great just as is. So whatever minor changes, I have an index card in the kitchen that is out of reach right now. So which might have a slightly different recipe, but I know this was the basis for it. So I'm just going to link that. Debbie made it, apparently. Debbie with an I. Debbie with an I and three number ones. It's an interesting spelling. Anyway, okay. So, wilderness travel. What did I want to say about wilderness travel, and what can I say in the 15 minutes that I have left? For the better part of a week here in the Discord server, a rather ongoing discussion, a protracted discussion about wilderness. I don't want to say wilderness travel. This is actually the problem. This is where I'm going to start. Okay. There's two things in here. Let me start with this. Number one, there is going to be an angry wilderness hack. It's coming. It's not coming next month or the month after, but it is coming. Okay, it's, you know, it is now on the docket. I have a system, one that will work for D&D, and I will, you know, write it up and give it out once I polish it off. Okay, so there's that. Secondly, it is, you know, wilderness is going to be a core component of Slapdash. Okay. And there's a reason why I keep admitting the word wilderness travel. So I can get away with a little more fuzzy discussion about it now. I'm not going to try and spell out absolutely everything that came out of that. What I'm going to say is this. The biggest problem with developing a wilderness system is that word, travel. Okay? It is that... Essentially, when it comes to trying to figure out how to, let's say, handle the wilderness in tabletop role-playing games, it is almost always addressed first and foremost as the wilderness is the place characters travel through. Okay, the wilderness is essentially a background. It is the space between the town and the adventure. And so whenever people start designing rules for wilderness, they start from that perspective. That this is about how do the adventurers get from point A to point B? So what do I need to do to figure that out? Okay, obviously I need movement rates, and we need to be able to figure out how to navigate, and we need to figure out how to do this. And then of course you'll start to add on questions like, well, if they're going to be out in the wilderness for several days, then they're going to need food and supplies and what have you, but people can live off the wilderness because we want wilderness survival to be a thing. And so we'll need to add like, and on the way you can forage, right? And that's how wilderness systems have generally been built. They're built with the assumption that the wilderness is a thing that you travel through, okay? And you're going from point A to point B. And so all the questions are related to, well, how do you get to, from point A to point B, and what happens on the way? Okay. The wilderness needs to be addressed as a component of the world with which the players interact. Okay. And that is a step that gets skipped. Okay. Because we don't think of the wilderness as... I'm not even saying a place for adventure. Okay. Because... So when you think about a dungeon, we think about the dungeon in terms of... No, dungeon's not even really the best way to think about it. Because even with the dungeon, when you basically think about a dungeon, is the dungeon is just the space where the encounters happen, right? So you have rooms, and then you have the connections between the rooms, and that's it. Bam, that's the whole dungeon. That's how we think about it, you know? So even then, there's flaws in that thought process. But, you know, you think about, So we have a serious problem here, where we're not thinking about the spaces in our universe, our gaming universe, as interactable spaces. We're thinking about them as containers for stuff or backgrounds. And so, you know, obviously there's a lot to build on this, and I can't find a good example of how you could think differently, because actually I'm discovering now that nobody thinks differently, which now becomes a problem. Because so the question really is, in what ways might the players interact with the wilderness? Okay. And when you start thinking about it in that front, or in that way, you're no longer limiting yourself to the idea that, you know, what I'm writing is a system for how people travel through the wilderness. Instead, I'm writing about there is a wilderness and players can do things in it. What things do players do in the wilderness? They do travel, of course. And then there is the you know, things like, you know, obviously navigating, you know. But break that down further. It's like, well, how do players... Or how do people navigate in the wilderness? Because right now the way we do it is roll a navigation check to get to your destination. Like you're basically, you know, like every character has a GPS skill, where it's just you roll the die and if it succeeds. And it's like, is that really how people travel through the wilderness? And clearly the answer is no, that's not. You don't, like... you don't just walk out into the wilderness and just navigate to a destination. You can't do that. That's impossible. Instead, you'll follow, there's something to follow, right? A road or a river or a trail. So, okay, now I understand one of the elements of the wilderness that people will interact with is trails or roads or rivers or, you know, or like trail markers or paths or even directions. People might have specific directions, like travel this way, you know, travel until you see this thing and then walk toward it. And then from that, you know, then climb up that hill. And from that hill, you'll see a little pond and then go to the pond and circle around the pond until you find the ruined monument. And then follow the game trail from the ruined monument until you get to the river. And then, you know, go up the river, yada, 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 directions, right? Because like, if you can't navigate visually, you really can't navigate. Because if you just, if you knew like, the dungeon is east of here in the forest and you just start walking east, you will never, ever find the dungeon. That is just not a way you can get to a destination. Okay, so instead you need to figure out what the interactions actually are. And if the players have a reason to suspect they're near the dungeon, they might start searching the wilderness. Right? Just like you would search a dungeon room for traps, you can search the forest for buildings. It's more time consuming. You have to cover a lot more space. It could take you hours or days, depending on the area you're covering, but it is something you can do. Like it's a reasonable thing people can do. And it's like, okay, well, what if now, how do the players get back? Can they retrace their steps? You know, can they leave a trail behind them? Which basically, can they track themselves in, you know, backwards? And things like that. But then you start thinking about other things like hunting and foraging. Because right now, the way we treat foraging is, it's sort of a bonus action. It's like, and while you're traveling, you can forage. Okay, that's fine, but if I want to increase the yield, can I just spend a day foraging or hunting? And what is the difference between hunting and foraging? You know, and how is that expressed mechanically? Because right now we just make a survival check and you are fed. And it's like, well, that's not really an interaction. That's a die roll, because die rolls are not interactions. So once you start analyzing the wilderness, not as a backdrop for travel, but as a part of the game world with which the players have all sorts of possible interactions, and then you start trying to imagine how those interactions must play out in terms of the gameplay conversation and in terms of what it would be like to be the person doing the thing, then you start building some very, very different mechanics. But you also start discovering that there are some major holes in the action resolution system that you need to plug to do this right. And I'll say this, because I want to say a little bit more on the idea of picturing how it is like to play this. So right now, the way we... I'm getting a message. I'm pacing a little bit, so I stepped away from the computer, but I imagine I'm being warned that I have only a little bit of time left. I have only 5 minutes left. Man, I could talk about this for an hour. If somebody had asked me about this instead of Demon Souls, I could have filled an hour of time talking about wilderness travel. Except that probably I couldn't, because I've now kind of talked it out. But, okay. So here's, where was I? Okay. The game is always going to be played in terms of the game master describing what the players can perceive or what the players' characters perceive, and the players choosing actions for their characters. That you must accept as the way the game is played. Yeah, Jorkhan, I'm really sorry. Jorkhan saying, that's why I put wilderness travel first. I get that. Which is also why I'm hanging out and talking about this. And while I'll just blow off Proselus and go for another 6 hours. What do I care? Okay. So where was I? Okay. So you know I have the power. So you know the game is played in terms of the game master must be... Anything that happens in a role-playing game, you must be able to resolve it in these terms. The game master must be able to describe the situation the players find themselves in. The players must be able to choose an action that interacts with the environment around them, and you must be able to then resolve that action. Okay? The problem with wilderness travel is that it is always done from 30,000 feet up, okay? So the GM will say, what do you do? And the players will say, we will travel to the dungeon. And the game master will say, that will take you 4 days. Roll a this check and a that check and check off this much food and then whatever, right? And that action declaration is handled as in terms of the goal of reaching the location without any reference to the world around the characters. Because that action is just impossible if you actually consider what the players are aware of or what the characters are aware of. Nobody get on me if I mix up player and character, okay? I know all the jokes. It's always, oh, you kill players and you shouldn't do that. That's murder, you know? Yeah, that shit's old now. Okay, anyway, so you must be able to, at the very least, tell the players what their characters perceive of the world around them and they must be able to interact with that world in a way that is a resolvable action. Okay. The we travel to the dungeon that is 3 days away is not based on the perception of the characters. Okay. It is based instead on the fact that everybody has a map on their table and they can click on the location that they want to reach and just say fast travel to location. Okay. So if you are going, even something as simple as building the travel rules, you still have to be able to describe to the players what is going on in the world around them, and they must make decisions based on that. So it's like, well, we will set out from the city and we will travel due north. That's an action I can resolve, right? I can say, okay, you attempt to travel due north. And conceivably, the character, like, okay, you know, you notice which side, if you have the survival skills, you know which way the shadows are pointing, so you know which way is east and west, and you know where the moss grows on the trees and all that shit, so you can kind of guess north and walk vaguely north, okay? But that alone is not actually going to get you to a destination. Which means that, like, navigation becomes a puzzle now, right? You have a map, like, the characters might have a map in the world. Now they have to look at that map and say, well, the only thing we can do is follow landmarks or travel in cardinal directions. Knowing that, when we look at this map, how can we find the location we want? Oh, well, it's along a river, and that river is to the east of here. So if we go east, we'll find the river, we can follow the river, and then travel, you know, go up river until we reach the destination. Of course, that can lead to more complicated challenges where if you know this town you're going to lies along a river, but you can't be sure whether you hit the river upriver or downriver of the town, you have to make a guess and you have to decide. And again, you will, as the characters, you'll have very limited information. So now you have to make a guess. Do we go upriver or downriver? And if you make the wrong guess, you could go a couple of days out of your way. And it's on you, the players, to then decide, okay, we've now walked upriver 3 days. It's time to assume we picked the wrong direction and walked downriver instead, right? Those are the ways that players navigate the world. And those are actions that you can resolve. And once you do that, you as the game master, you no longer give a shit about what their destination is. Like, the players don't have to tell. We're trying to get to the town on the river. I don't care where you're trying to get. Just tell me where you're walking. Oh, well, we're walking east. Okay, I can resolve that. And then I can say, you know, you travel east for 3 days and then you hit a river. And then the players, oh, we've hit the river. And, you know, which way is up river? Up river, describe it. And then they'll be like, well, we'll head up river. And you travel 7 days up river or whatever. Now, obviously, there's some rough edges here. This isn't perfect by itself. You need to file things down. And there's a really, really important issue about timekeeping. One that is very complicated and needs a very elegant solution, which of course I have, but speaking of timekeeping, I am out of time, so I can't talk about that tonight. So, plus this also plays into a really, really unique, a whole other set of game mechanics called, that have to do with task management. Arthur's got the wide eyes. Well, Arthur, it's your fault that we didn't have time to talk about this because you wanted Demon Souls. You are a monster. No. There will be more to say about this, obviously, on the website and also in next month's live chat, or if I do an ancillary live chat, or if you ambush me and get me talking about it again. But really, I do have to call it a night here. So I do want to thank everybody just for hanging out and chatting. Thank you, Nitsua, for hosting Bingo, and welcome back. I know you've been away for a bit, so welcome back. It's good to see you. Thank you, Procillus, for producing and giving me the extra half hour. Thank you, both Jorkon. I think it was Jorkon who kept track of the stuff for next month. Add timekeeping and task management on there too, Jorkon. I'm just going to have to start, you know what? I'm just going to start scheduling an hour and a half for these things. That's where it's always going to land, and people will hang out for that time. And if people can't hang out for the whole time, they can always listen to the recording afterwards. Okay. Oh, and welcome back, Dusty, too. I realize that you have just recently reappeared in the server in the last few days. Or am I crazy? Yeah, I know. You went through a period where you were going through some busyness, and I kind of assumed that's where you were, that life. So I hope things are going well for you. I also want to especially, I want to thank Dusty and October Foundry for also, and Ice Bear too, specifically for just checking up on me and seeing how I'm doing and just showing general concern. I really do appreciate that. It has been a really, really hard time. The hardest time I have faced in my life. I say that without hyperbole. And it's taking a lot longer to come back from that than I had hoped, but I am trying. So I really appreciate everything everyone does and all of the patience and all of the support. And of course, all the financial support. And hopefully now that I'm on a more regular content release schedule and I keep that up, the financial support is actually worth it. And it will only become more so as I start giving you scenario design and Slapdash and all of those other wonderful things and angry hacks. So that is all. So with that, good night, everybody. Happy May. And I guess that's it. I guess click.